This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the CSM Podcast with David Nickturn. Creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Blending spiritual and temporal realities, joining heaven and earth. We will be talking with a variety of manifestors, individuals who have, in one way or another, clarified their vision, created an offering, and brought that offering to the marketplace. Let's see what we can learn from them as we each move forward towards solving our own life puzzle, facing the challenge of living in the spirit, in the body, in the world, in this time. If you're interested in supporting the CSM podcast, please visit beherenownetwork.com/David.
Greetings, everybody. This is David Nickturn. Our podcast, Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck. I have an extra special guest with me today, 2020. And this is my very dear old friend, Michael Carroll, who is a teacher, a Dharma teacher, an author of some repute, and been my Dharma brother for many decades as we've kind of journeyed through the worldly path and through the Buddhist path and trying to interweave those two. So he's a perfect guest for this particular podcast. Michael's a teacher in the Kagyu Nyingma and Shambhala lineages in the tradition of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. So that's how we're brothers. He's an author of Awake at Work and The Mindful Leader and Fearless at Work and Mindful Leadership Training. Michael began practicing meditation in 1976. First teacher was Dujem Rinpoche. And he's been basically part of the Trungpa Rinpoche Sangha since then. So we go back, I guess, about 40 years, Michael. Isn't that the case? Oh, my God. Do you remember the first time we met?
Do you remember my former wife actually worked for you for some time, if you recall, back when you had the sink love here.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's how we met?
I had met you prior. I was in the New York Sangha, obviously, and I was a young man there. I moved to New York when I was 22. And I kind of bumped into you as part of that scene down there. But, you know, it was more of a sort of a gradual weaving together. I think you and Justine hit it off, and she worked in your office for quite some time. And that's kind of, and then also I remember babysitting for someone else's son. But that's how I think we met is very gradually when you were doing the sink clavier thing.
So, you know, one thing we share in common, and I wanted to ask you about this among many other things, is the kind of original presentation of Trungpa Rinpoche in the West, which, as you know, we're finding many, many people coming around these days and very, very interested in pursuing that further. And you, for example, have orchestrated a course with yourself and myself and four other senior teachers in the art tradition based on the Shambhala, the Sacred Path of the Warrior book that Trungpa Rinpoche wrote. And we've had a huge influx of people. We've had over 1,000 people coming to that online program. And they all seem to be vividly curious about this teacher who had passed away 30 years ago, but who left quite a body of work. So, of course, that would be part of what would be fun to talk about. A lot of people are interested in, who listen to the podcast, are interested in Trungpa Rinpoche and his teachings. And then the other thing that we've shared that's kind of so bonding, really, is we're kind of worldly, gregarious, outer-going, non-scholarly, active in the world people who see the spine of our existence in the world as really a deep dive into the Buddhist teachings, but are really working very hard, like as you can tell from the title of your books, towards bringing that out towards, let's say, people who are operating out in the field. Yeah. So I thought I'd start by asking a little bit about your professional career, and then we could get back to the Dharma thing, because sure. I know you've had quite a few powerful jobs in the corporate world and so forth.
Sure.
Could you tell us like how you got started professionally?
Sure.
First jobs and
it all started with getting off at the wrong subway station. Frankly, my parents were very kind to me and had me go away to college where I studied theology and philosophy.
Oh,
I have a degree in theology and I suppose I have a degree in philosophy because I had a double major. So I don't know. And that's really what I was interested in my life, was that kind of thing. And I moved to New York City with a friend of mine, Donna Thornton. And we were just young kids. I think I was 22 and she might have been 21. And I got a job at Columbia University and I was studying and enjoying myself. And I met His Holiness Duchamp Rinpoche, which was a very formative, defining experience to this day. It just changed the whole thing, just shifted the whole thing. And part of that experience was that I was not ready and really needed to go and have my diapers changed, et cetera, spiritually. And I was encouraged to go and study with Trungpa Rinpoche. Now, I had heard of him and kind of had little interchange, but it was at that point that I began to study very, very deliberately Buddhism. And you've heard the story where, I went to seminary and I was so proud of myself and thought that I was getting all the goodies and I was going to go and have an interview with Trungpa Rinpoche. To ask him what was my next step now that I graduated from seminary and we had the Nundro disciplines ahead of us and stuff. But I was like, I want to ask him, what's my next step? And I was pretty sure that he would say, he would recognize, my stellar qualities and my advanced accomplishments and say something like, go study with the Karmapa or you should become a monk or I want to give you a very esoteric retreat or something. I was expecting that. And as I was asking him what to do next, he just looked at me and he said, go get a job. I was so arrogant at the time. And I guess I still am, but hopefully a little less, that I assumed that he must have misunderstood me. But maybe he thought I was someone else, right? So I just started explaining again and again. And you know him well, so you know this experience. And I explained it again, hoping that he would realize who I was. And he just looked over his glasses and said to me, you can do it. Give it a try. Mm. And, at the time, it was very disconcerting. I felt like I had been thrown out into the cold, so to speak. So I went back to New York, got my master's degree in education, adult education, did my thesis on executive development, et cetera, so forth. And then I got a job on Wall Street. I was on Wall Street for about 7 years, Shearson Lehman, Payne Weber. Then moved over to Simon & Schuster, where that was sort of my first really big job. The other jobs were important. They were
Mike, how did you go from a philosophy degree to working at those companies? What qualified?
Well, I mean, I just went to school and studied, and then I got an internship. I wrote my thesis actually on McClellan's Competent Manager, which is the source of Goleman's emotional and social intelligence work. These were early studies on competency modeling, which was of great interest to me, to be able to describe behaviors with great accuracy. In any case, I went on a couple of interviews and got a job at a bank, you know, as a junior officer, and, you know, I had to make a living somehow. And it basically just followed Rinpoche's instructions, go home, get a job, you know.
Yeah.
So I just moved up the ranks, and at Simon & Schuster, I was head of human resources for all of Simon & Schuster's operations, which was a pretty big job, and then moved over to Disney, where I was the head of human resources for Disney Publishing Worldwide. So I've had senior, all HR, human resources jobs in corporate settings, yeah, about 25 years doing that kind of stuff, and then have moved on to... I do a lot of work now with executive coaching and deploy coaches as well in a lot of scientific settings. So I work with statisticians and clinical researchers and scientists, but also in entertainment. I work with a lot of small creative teams and boards, mostly around, so I'll give you an example, you know, statisticians and data scientists have been critical all along. But now, particularly in certain settings, the data that they're generating with predictive analytics is really vital. But before, they were simply expected to deliver the information, and then the operating executives would use the information to make business decisions or various types of decisions. Now they're expected to actually influence with the data, not just deliver the data. Those types of social intelligence skills are fairly sophisticated, and most statisticians aren't trained, nor was the expectation placed upon them typically to deliver on those kinds of leadership influencing skills. So I'm often invited to work with senior data scientists in that way to help them become more skillful in influencing and decision making. So that's basically.
Yeah, and when you brought in on situations like that, would you refer to the fact that you're also a Buddhist teacher? Would that wouldn't even mention that?
No. I keep all of that now because I've written books. They do the research on my background when they're interviewing me, and they may note it that hey, you've written some books, and I kind of that my the issue for me isn't to inflict meditation on people. I mean that. That's not the goal. The goal is to help people solve problems and to inspire the best in others and to elevate themselves. And in the process, more often now than used to be, some of these folks say, dude, how did you start thinking that way? How did you get that?
Yeah.
I said, well, you know, you have to train your mind not to believe everything it's saying to itself, you know? So some of the people I work with begin to use meditation, and I'm more than happy to introduce it. And in fact, I do introduce it in many settings. But that's, I never lead with that. You really want to understand what the other person's going through rather than walk in with a solution, so to speak.
So, Mike, what's your version of a really great day?
I'm a very fortunate man, first and foremost. So I actually wake up in a world that is safe, clean, healthy. I wake up with a friend who I've been with, Susanna, for a long time, and I love her very much. So I'm a very fortunate man just to wake up in the world that I'm not naive as to what the rest of this world is going through. A lot of suffering, a lot of situations. But with that said, that's the foundation for my life. And one could say it's entitled, and to a great degree it is, but I also count myself as fortunate. But what is a good day? You know, I think it's a combination of always being available to the larger picture, which we all know about as Buddhists. Always being available to that, whether it's, you know, looking at a bee or meeting someone or seeing the sky. And at the same time, doing stuff, you know, just doing stuff, you know. I'm helping someone run a meeting with his team on how do you get inside the skin of a stakeholder.
Oh.
You know, how do you see what is valued from those that you provide services to? Well, that's a lot of fun.
That almost sounds like a book right there.
Yeah. So yeah. I think it's waking up as a fortunate human being, being right around people like you, David, being able to look at the sky and get the full picture.
Yeah.
And having that happen quite a lot during the day. And then doing cool stuff and helping people. I guess that's a good day for me.
Yeah. Nice. Do you feel that there is something ahead of you in terms of your notion of either career or practice that is unfulfilled?
Yes. And I'm actually in the middle of completing that. I wouldn't say the middle. I'm in the middle of the first third. And I think the essence of it is that I feel a certain responsibility, as I think you do as well, is to express what we've been given in ways that is helpful to others. And there are, I've completed, you and I have talked about Luma's dignity, fourth ring issues, and completing a commentary on that, and those kinds of things. So there's certain teachings that you and I have received that aren't as explicitly from Trungpa Rinpoche, that have not been as explicitly articulated, that I feel I still have to do that. It's not really that much for public consumption, as my books are. It has a lot to do with how do we enter into a world that's so confused from a tantric point of view and engage it in a way that inspires the best in the world. And Trungpa Rinpoche went to great lengths to train us about that. And so I still feel I have more work to do in sort of establishing what I learned and what he gave me.
Yeah. And how about professionally? Do you feel like there's something unfulfilled there? Or is it all one thing?
No, it's everything has a compartment. It's all in the same house where everything, I do keep somewhat separate. No, honestly, David, I guess, that's a good question. That's actually, now that I think about it, there is probably one final professional thing that I would like to do, but I'm probably not going to do it, which is essentially where I see things going over the next 30 years, maybe even 50 years, in terms of global business, is there's a linchpin about how human beings interact with one another. And it used to be around leadership. It used to be how leadership works and how leadership moves among different people, frontline leadership, corporate leadership, the senior most level leadership, team leadership, project leadership, all good stuff. An area where I have done a lot of work and it's important stuff. But it's shifting now that a mindful leader or a great leader is not going to be the linchpin for the global workplace. It's an authentic colleague.
Wow. Is that a term that you coined or somebody else has coined?
No, I guess it's I'm sure someone's talked about authentic colleagues, but
I never heard it before.
Well, no, I coined that phrase, but if there's somebody in the audience going, dude, I came up with that word before.
Dude. There's definitely people in this audience saying, dude, whatever.
Well, I apologize.
Yeah, no, it's good. So authentic colleague as opposed to the leadership.
That's correct.
Does that mean it's eye level, Mike?
What is really the defining relationship is the eye level relationship, because things are self-organizing now. And where we're seeing a lot of the initial dynamics to that are around agile teams. And for people in your audience who know what agile teams are, it isn't just an agile team. It's a very specific way of empowering teams that are close to highly dynamic situations that constantly need adaptation. And those teams have to adapt very quickly, a lot around technology, those kinds of things. And you don't have to go back to corporate to come up with an idea. You have to adapt. And the way that's often done is collegially and intelligently. And what you rely on isn't a leader. You rely on colleagues that you can trust, that you have chemistry with. And that is increasingly in the competencies required to be able to build a culture that puts the authentic colleague at the apex of what you're trying to achieve. I don't think that's being explored as well as it will be in the very near future. I think I have a lot of insight into all the basic behaviors that are required there.
Now, how does that correlate? Because I feel like you're saying something really powerful here, and it's the kind of circular model rather than the pyramid model of collaboration, you know? Mm-hmm. And it seems to be bumping into it. So some people are saying, you know, in Buddhist terms, it'd be the Sangha is extremely important.
Yeah.
The community is really important, the kind of collegial quality of that. How does that correlate with what I think could easily be seen as an extremely hierarchical model within Tibetan Buddhism in particular, and Vajrayana in particular, in which the guru is kind of considered to be, pinnacle of some kind of experience. And, and so it's very hierarchical in some sense. How would you correlate those two perceptions?
Well, obviously, I'm a very fortunate man to have met, a truly fully realized, Vajra master. And I'm not saying that as like some kind of sycophant here. If anyone had met Trungpa Rinpoche, you would know exactly what I'm talking about right now. So I'm very fortunate to have met a traditionally trained Vajra master. I wouldn't recommend having a Vajra master to many people. I mean, that's not like, hey, everyone ought to have a Vajra master or something. But I also was fortunate in that I think Trungpa Rinpoche understood that he was handing a very ancient tradition off to a modern world. And I think he also had a tremendous amount of confidence in us, frankly, that he could hand it to us. Now, some of us dropped the ball, and I honestly can say that I haven't been always the best student as well. But I think one of the things that I've learned about the hierarchical aspect of Vajrayana and how I think a key element of that going forward in terms of the preservation of Vajrayana in the West is that a lot of the theming kind of exaggeration of like overly effusive praise of the teacher, the infallibility of the teacher, all of those kinds of superlatives, increasingly are more obscuring the issue than clarifying. And the issue in my mind about the guru is really the essence of it is love. The essence of it is devotion. Whether I think Trungpa Rinpoche was an enlightened being or not, really something's more fundamental. I am deeply grateful to him. I'm deeply grateful to Trungpa Rinpoche for showing me what they showed me. I love them for what they did for me.
Yeah. But how does that, were they your authentic colleague? Just coming back to your.
Oh, okay, good. No, thank you.
just seeing you. Going around the park and coming back onto that. That's right. Sort of, it's an interesting place to land from what you just said. You know.
Yeah. So this is the, thank you for doing that. This sense of deep appreciation of the other person is that the, is one of the core elements of the authentic colleague. And you can see it in military. Military have been using this authentic colleague model for quite a long time. They may not have called it authentic colleague model. You know, there's a great hierarchy of levels of, you know, lieutenants and first lieutenants and captains and majors and all that kind of stuff.
And in business as well.
Absolutely. But when it really comes down to it, what is the fabric that holds together a military team? It's devotion to one another. There's a deep sense of devotion and care about one another's well-being, about one another's lives, and trust and support for one another. That dynamic is at the very core of this devotion that is very human and is very authentic. That's why the word I use, it's like being an authentic human being. Gratitude. So that's where I think there might be I think there is a shared set of dynamics there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure in the business world, people are exploring paradigms, you know, for even the root paradigm, which is what's the point of the company. For example, you know, both you and I have had entrepreneurial activities and you create something. And what's the root paradigm for creating a company? Is arguably the kind of limiting one is the idea of generating profit and growth to the point where that's it. That's how you measure the success of the outing. And, you know, I have a chapter in my book, Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck, about what is success? What does it really mean to be successful? So you... explore the paradigm of putting a company together, that is not the only consideration, or a government. For example, that when we look at our government's success, it's measured in terms of, like right now, we're in the middle of a tremendous crisis in terms of leadership and what government even is for. And if you look at it and only measure it by GDP, you know, and the stock market, and the, you know, what money is going back into people's wallets, tax cuts, blah, blah, blah. And you don't look at the health of the human beings in the society. Wouldn't you say that's kind of part of a big problem that we're working out right now?
No, I don't think that's a problem. Well,
how do we get around it? How does your view take us around that?
Well, you know, I'll go back to my work in mindful leadership. And I enjoyed making this point and continue to enjoy making this point. I use a story as I typically do. I remember this one assignment with a physician leader. I do a lot of work with physician leaders. And he was interviewing me to be his coach. And he said to me, he goes, you know, to me, leadership is pretty simple. My job is to get from point A to point B as efficiently and as profitably as possible.
There you go.
It's that simple.
I said, and he was a doctor, this guy?
A physician leader, right?
Wow.
And I said, you know, hey, that's pretty good. I think you got about 83% there. But to me, there's a very important ingredient here that getting from point A to point B as efficiently and as profitably and as effectively as possible is great. But if we arrive at point B without our collective sanity intact, we have failed.
And how did he respond to that?
He got it.
Uh-huh.
Because I said, right after that, I said, look, you can meet your numbers, you can meet your goals, you can meet your timetables, but if your divorce rate is up, your turnover rate and your engagement is up, your drug addiction is up within your population, you failed. Now, you may not think you failed, and God bless, I'm not here to convince you.
Yeah.
But if you want to have a coach to help you become a great leader, that has to be a priority, because without that, there is no success. It's a sine qua non. It would be like, here's the example I use. I said, you have kids, right? He goes, yeah. I said, okay. I said, imagine you're going to send them to camp. And you go to one camp, and it's a nice camp. It looks really good. And you say, okay, what's your safety record here? And the first camp goes, it's great. We have doctors and nurses on site. We have an ambulance over here. We have a tent that's always ready. And we have not one incident over the 25 years, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, well, that's pretty impressive. Then you go to the other camp, and they go, we try to do our best. You know, we look out for the kids. And you go, well, what's your record here? So honestly, over the 25 years, only a couple kids have died here. Now, when you go back and you sit down with your spouse and you try to determine which one you go to, do you look at which one costs less? Do you look at how many hours they offer for the investment? No, you know, it's not even a question. Uh-huh. Well, that's how it should be in the workplace.
Well, how do you think it's gotten so divorced from that? I mean, arguably, we're not even close.
I wouldn't say we're not even close, but I get what you're talking about. I think there are, while I can catalog a whole range of indictments of the modern workplace as a greedy, crass, and selfish environment, I can equally catalog a whole range of uplifted and inspiring elements as well. So I think it's a mix. That's number one. But I think there's a number one reason why the health and well-being and the elevation of human beings is not a singular element of most organizations, modern organizations. And it's one word, fear. Dead, fear.
Yeah.
And that then spirals into greed, selfishness, panic, ignorance, all kinds of dynamics.
What do you think people are afraid of?
Well,
in this context, what's the big one?
Well, in the workplace, fear is really powerful. And if, as your audience would just reflect for a moment, it can be as simple as, afraid to lose our job. Mm-hmm. If I don't have a job, how am I going to pay my bills? I got my kid, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. People are afraid to lose their job. But even if you have a job and you're not for leisure, you're afraid to maybe be marginalized. You go to a meeting and your boss doesn't know, or whatever. Right?
Yeah.
And it goes on from there. I mean, I've seen fear in the workplace, which is of great interest to me for a long, long, long time.
If you characterize your own fear, is it possible to do that?
Me? Myself? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's evolved. Uh-huh. When I first started, it was a very similar fear that I think I, to a great degree, inherited from my father. It was a fear that I wouldn't be able to pull it off. I just wouldn't be able to pull this off.
Yeah, whatever this.
Whatever this is. I would fail.
Yeah, wow. You know? It's deep.
Yeah, that I couldn't pull it off. And then, when it evolved from there, I mean, I've been very fortunate in most of my jobs. My former boss brought me along with him or her because there was chemistry there. So to a great degree, I haven't had to have a lot of that stuff. But I've had some difficult missteps in my career. And so I think that would be the essence of my fear is I can't pull this off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they say all dharmas agree at one point, right? Mm-hmm. Lojong slogan.
Sure.
What point is that? What is that point?
We're all
dharmas. Nobody ever asked that question. What is that point?
We're all dharmas agree. Well, I would interpret that slogan as the word dharma, not referring to the dharmas of teaching, of enduring moments.
Yeah.
That every moment that you have in your your life resolves itself into a truth.
Uh-huh.
Either you're hesitating or you're not.
Uh-huh.
It's one or the other.
Oh.
One or the other. Either you're trying to navigate yourself through life or you're actually living it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is very Michael Carroll right here at this moment, ladies and gentlemen. This is really the nub of. So, and it's digital. It's binary.
It gives itself the impression that it's binary.
Either you are navigating or you're living.
It gives itself the impression that you have that choice.
But?
You don't. You're living with or without your permission anyway.
You're living with or without your permission. That's funny. Yeah.
But you're giving yourself the impression that you have a choice,
which is
called samsara.
Samsara is the delusion that you have some kind of choice about being there or not being there.
That's right. And then I can construct an entire storyline around the Mikey show.
Right. So is there a better environment to kind of, test that premise than everyday life in the ordinary world?
No, and I think that was one of the great, Tomo Rinpoche, I think, could be summarized into maybe a dozen, really fundamental, profound instructions for the modern world, one of which is that your life is perfectly arranged to attain enlightenment. Perfectly arranged. And that one can engage the melody of circumstance of your modern life in such a way that it can accelerate the insight into the fundamental element of what it means to be human. So whether you're a truck driver, nurse, mom, dad, whether you're disabled or not, that when you fully understand the circumstances that you're in, it can accelerate your ability to wake up.
Now, leaping from there to we're in an incredible moment, right? As we're talking, I'm sure by the time the podcast is on the air in a couple of weeks, everything's going to look somewhat different. What the heck do you think is going on in America right now? from your birth, your sky mind view, the big picture, there's something going on that is bigger than the narrative that's happening or the various narratives.
I think there's two things here from my vantage point. And again, this is just now the Mikey feel.
That's all I'm asking for.
Yeah, I mean, the one dynamic is that I became radicalized at around 13 years old. I knew I was being lied to by, Jimmy Swaggart, Catholic Church, Vietnam, everything. I mean, every time I kept pressing in to investigate, I knew I could smell this is a lie. And as I grew older and I developed myself spiritually, I probably didn't pay attention to politics that much. But I guess the point is, I'm not surprised by this. I'm not surprised that half the country, after having 4 years of an unvarnished view of a profoundly mentally ill sociopath, serial sexual predator criminal running our government, actually comes to the conclusion that that is a preferred experience. I am not surprised by that because I smelled it back when I was 13 years old. And the fact that Donald Trump exists, people like you and I look at that as an appalling issue, but it's frankly a mirror. That's how this country has been seen by people for a long time, whether you're an indigenous person from this country or you're a Vietnamese or you're from Latin America. That level of sloppy, loud, condescending incompetence has been how we have been seen for centuries. So nothing new there.
Uh-huh.
We all live in this country is built, you should read the book Fantasy Land.
Okay.
America is living in a fantasy land. It's been built on fantasy land. It lives in fantasy land, and it can't, it's addicted to fantasies. And this has been a WWE, 4 years of WWE, basic. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't beauty to this country, obviously. There's great greatness in this country, but I'm not surprised by it. But the other dynamic is the Ekajati principle. Her fingerprints are all over this.
Okay, you have to tell people in the audience who Ekajati is.
Now, Ekajati is a protector within the Vajrayana. And she is, in my estimation, maybe someone else could enlighten me as to otherwise, but she's the boss for all intents and purposes in terms of all the other protectors, and is widely recognized as one of the, if not the most potent protectors of the most advanced teachings on the planet, let alone other things that she does. But her, and she has minions of very skillful mamos and dynamics that are involved with creation and destruction, and you know this all day.
Yeah, but there's...
Oh, I forgot your audience.
X number of people who are listening who might not even have a clue what you're talking about.
Yeah, I apologize.
No, that's okay. Just fill them in.
Yeah.
So explain what you mean by protection.
Yeah, so the issue here isn't that there is a deity floating around by the name of Ekajati. What this dynamic is about is that we typically think that the phenomenal world is this object. You know, it's like a tree. You cut it down, you turn it into toothpicks, you know, whatever, you know. But in reality, when we actually experience wakefulness in a synchronized way with the phenomenal world, we realize that that what appeared to be inanimate is in fact intelligent. And it's awake. It has a grammar, a syntax to it, and how you have a conversation with it. Ekajati is kind of the language of the phenomenal world. And there are many qualities to how she works, but one of them, in the way I would explain it, I know we have a short time, but it's the experience of a sudden shift, where what was not perceived before suddenly becomes profoundly apparent. And often it isn't a very pleasant experience. Often it's not a very pleasant experience. And this experience of COVID is 100% a Ekajati move. 1 minute we're all moving along with our cars that start perfectly and our half and half in the refrigerator. And I apologize because people are not as fortunate or as entitled as I am, but we live pretty good in this country. And then 2 seconds later, the whole thing shifts.
Yeah.
And what is this? Who am I? What can I do? What is my relationship with you? What is my relationship with myself? You know, what is the relationship with the rest of the world? That kind of sudden shift. Where what
like the rug is being pulled.
That's correct. That's an Ekajati move.
Yeah, pull that rug.
It happens very suddenly.
Yeah.
And it wakes you up. It isn't particularly pleasant, but mm-hmm. It wakes you up. Mm-hmm. So in order to relate with it, as I've been trained, you relate with those awakenings as sacred.
Even though they're quieting in a way or unsettling, have the view that this might be a good thing rather than a purely negative experience, because it has potential to shift your perspective, move you into a more integrated way of working and being.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I think what you said is accurate. But you don't treat those movements as sacred because you're expecting to learn something from them.
Uh-huh.
You treat them as sacred because they are fundamentally real. Being human and being vulnerable like this is real. There's a crudeness to it that is so real that my little bits of my liquid can get in your mouth and kill you. It's so real.
So much for French kissing, huh?
Yeah, well, there will be a time. We'll be not for me, I'm too old, but that deserves great humility and great respects. That these dynamics are worthy of our dignity or our humility. That's all. That's how I see it.
Yeah. And do you have a plan
for what?
For anything?
Well, yeah. I mean, I try to keep enough money in the bank so that I don't, you know, I can go to the store and, you know, stuff like that. I don't really have a bucket list. I would like to. I remember going on an adventure with my dad to the Grand Canyon. And I love that little area where you come from Albuquerque and drive all the way up to Canada and just enjoy yourself there. And I just love meditating on the edge of the Grand Canyon. You know, you can. It's big, as you know, and you can just drive out, park your car, walk into the woods, and all of a sudden you're at the edge of this thing and sit down. And so that would be something I'd like to plan to do that. I'd love that.
To go to the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, meditate. It's really fun just sitting there.
It reminded me of when I went to Bhutan. You may or may not remember this, but I went up to Taksang, which is the cave where Padmasambhava used to meditate, which is in a sheer cliff that you have to kind of go up a pretty steep mountain climb to get to. Famous place, Tiger's Nest. And I got there and I feel like, wow, we're talking about the 8th century AD. And that's when this cave was, you know, occupied by him. Right. And now there's a monastery built around it that has burned to the ground and has also been refurbished, but it's still quite primitive. And you're sort of at this power spot in the world, and I'm sitting there kind of, you know, after I went into the cave and I'm looking at my phone, I went like, oh my god, I have bars here. And I called you from there. But you weren't home, and I left you a message.
Yeah, I think I remember getting that little message.
So that's, you know, that's sort of an interesting overlay of our lives, that connection, because we do have some kind of. And many people who are coming around now, Mike, have this connection with Padmasambhava and, you know, something about the ancient kind of teachings and resonating and shamanic traditions and Hinduism. And, you know, I'm sure a few people are exploring their own ancestral traditions, but, you know, there's a lot of interest in those. And then there's the existing ruins, if you will. Like if you go to India, there's the ruins of those civilizations, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to Thailand, you know, places like that. And we're in some way really tuning into that. And we had a gift, which was we had a translator, a famous translator called Trungpa Rinpoche, who was able to take that, not just the language, but culture, and portal it into, like, you know, basically giving us a way to access that information, which would have been very, very hard to access. And yet, at the same time, and there we are, you know, with our grandkids on the, here we are on a Zoom call, and our grandkids, you know, are probably going to be more virtual than real most of the time, you know, in terms of their actual experience of the phenomenal world. And we're supposed to bridge those two things. I really feel like that's the unique quality of our generation, and why we're, you know, making our serious pitch, as opposed to, like, you know, okay, into the sunset, let me take it easy now. A lot of people like you, yourself and myself, I know, are almost doubly activated to go. We have to take our last good effort at you know, communicating the fact that we knew the blues masters. It's like, you know, there are no blues, I use that analogy a lot, there are no blues masters anymore. There's no such thing. The cause and conditions that created Muddy Waters and you know, Junior Walker and you know, and B.B. King, of course, exist to some extent, but, you know, the people who were there and heard that and studied that have a certain appreciation for it that has to be passed on in a new way. And then there's a lot of young people who just somehow are smelling it out, and they're looking at old coots like us, and they're going like, you know, connect these dots with me. And it's just an interesting time because ordinary conventional reality, you and I would be like really laying back right now.
Yeah. but I don't think you and I are laying back, that's for sure.
Yeah. So it's interesting. And if there was something, let's say you wanted to take something from Padmasambhava's cave, and do you have a grandson now?
I have a granddaughter.
Granddaughter.
I have another grandchild too, yeah.
You are? You having a second one?
Yeah, well, my son and his wife are, but yeah.
Well, you're having a grandchild.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So your granddaughter is how old?
2.
And you know, I have Izzy, Ethan's daughter, who's 3. And if you could portal, be the conduit for something from Padmasambhava to your 2-year-old granddaughter, what would you want to bring across and give?
I would say, I think the key issue, and this is one of the other maybe top 12 things that Todor Rinpoche gave us, is the provocation of magic.
Okay.
That magic is real. That it's not magic bunny out of the hat thing. We're talking about that. We're talking about, you and I have seen this, right, with being around these teachers, that there is a whole way of relating with the phenomenal world that is remarkably unexplainable. And that you can become familiar with that if you're willing to treat the world as sacred and to be gentle. That's what I'd like to
call. That's what you want to say to your granddaughter.
And show her how to do it. And show her how to actually provoke magic.
Yeah. What's her name?
Her name is Nina.
So there's you and Nina. And how old does she have to be for you to have the conversation?
I could do it now. how do you look at a, how do you actually look at a bee?
Mm.
Like, you might think you're seeing a bee, but if you cannot see the bee, when you look at a bee, you see a bee. A bee, it's a bumblebee. What are you talking about? What happens if you realize that that's a concept,
mm-hmm.
and you actually see that?
So you want to introduce Nina to the magic of the phenomenal world that she's inheriting.
That's right.
And show her how to relate to that.
Yeah, and provoke it.
Provoke it. Yeah, you said that twice. Provoke. What is provoke?
In the best sense of the word, not provoke like teasing it.
Right.
But it's like dancing. It's like. It's more like when you dance and you play with your partner and your partner goes, oh, I like that. That's cool. I'm there. That's what I'm talking about, is how do you dance and play with it in such a way that it responds.
Right. And in terms of you as the recipient, you know, to receive, what would make you happiest to receive from Nina? Coming back the other way.
Now, unfortunately, you're asking me the wrong person, and this, my wife hates this about me, is I don't need anything from her.
Smile.
Whatever I get makes me the happiest man in the world.
Where do they live?
They just live 40 minutes away here. They live here in Pennsylvania, so I get to see it. Well, we don't get to see it because of the COVID thing. My son is a law enforcement agent for the prevention of cruelty to animals.
So he's
an animal protection cop. So he's out in the world quite a lot. And
is he still going out and about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He does his job. They don't live on the edge of poverty, but he can't be unemployed. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So he has to work. And in the cop, they do need in cities and in rural areas, they do need people to enforce those laws. So he has plenty of work to do, but we can't hang, you know what I mean, as much because of the COVID thing.
And are you working on any new book?
Well, I just completed the commentary. And it's a 60,000-word commentary. So that's done, and it's in the editor's hands to get printed.
But that's not a public book, right? That's,
no, it's not a public book.
Any public writing that you're contemplating?
No, this authentic colleague thing, I have it all outlined, and I have a lot of the competency models written up, and it has a lot to do also with the authentic word is also in relationship to artificial intelligence and how artificial intelligence, we have to understand how to relate with it properly. And so I have it all outlined, but I'm not going to write it. I have other things I want to do.
That seems like a very potent concept, and I haven't heard it. That doesn't mean it's not all over the place, but the authentic colleague as a leadership model. I'm building out a platform called Dharma Moon, which is going to be a kind of online community for people interested in this kinds of things we're interested in, and also the creative dimension of life. And I just naturally started forming. When I'm sending out the communiques to the people we're working on these things, I say team. I chose the word team rather than anything else. Like team sports, you know, for example, you could look at a football team and you could say, well, the quarterback is like kind of like the guy calling the shots, but on some level, he's no more important than the left tackle.
Football, yeah, it moves around.
Yeah, it moves around. And so the notion of teamwork seems like, and there's also, I say it's an old cliche, but there's no I in team.
Sure.
You know, and this seems to me to be like people could wrap their minds more around this notion of teamwork and lessing the I thing. A lot of people I talk to just dial that down some, that I thing, even if it's in a spiritual context that, okay, there's one person who's like Mr. Universe or whatever. There's a collage around those people. And even when Buddha taught, right, there's the Buddha, but there's all the bodhisattvas and the arhats, and sometimes they're giving the teachings, you know. So this spreading out into mandala principle, it seems like, and then to have a word for it that works in the Western context, authentic colleague. I don't know. I would buy that book if I saw it in a store. I'm just saying.
Well, thank you. But one final situation here, and this is important, is when we were growing up, David, how we affiliated with situations. I mean, I affiliated with the Catholic Church because my parents were Catholic and they sent me there. So I affiliated.
Yeah.
That's not how it works now. If I'm interested in bumblebees that wear top hats, you know, that's all I'm really interested in, I can just Google bumblebee top hat, and there's like a little group of people around the world.
Yeah.
So this ability to naturally and organically and improvisationally affiliate is an increasingly powerful skill of modern humanity. But when you show up in those affiliations, you have to know how to be authentic. You have to understand the social intelligence skills to affiliate skillfully. So you don't want to really deny the I. You just want to show up with an I that's skillful, so to speak.
Yeah, and interactive.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to give a word up for, you know, you have the quality of appearing kind of innocent, you know, like I stand on by the side of the road and I didn't do it, you know, I didn't do anything. You know, and all this traffic going on and the new stadium is being built behind you. And I'm just hanging out here. So, but you crystallize a lot of interesting activity, and you have, you teach all over the world and you consult with people, but you have a group that you've kind of crystallized called the Wisdom Seat.
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting project. And we've been collaborating under that and doing the Shambhala Path of the Warrior book under that. Is there anything you could tell people about the Wisdom Seat that would to find out about it? Or
thank you for inviting. You know, a friend of mine, Matt DeRodeo, you know, Matt, many years ago, we felt that in the Mid-Atlantic area, there were a lot of Vajrayana practitioners particularly, but they weren't affiliated in such a way that we had a kind of a scale to invite teachers. So we all kind of came together. There's students of Trungpa Rinpoche and Khandro Rinpoche and Tsongtsar Khyentsey and Dzogchen controversy.
Is it explicitly Tibetan Buddhist or are there
other? No. It is because we're all of that thing. But, you know, Zen, we're open to, we're very open to situations like that. But our, most of the folks in the community have been trained in Vajrayana and Mahayana. But in any case, we just started inviting teachers and they would come, and we're right near Swarthmore College, and we're right near Pendle Hill, which is a very, very active Quaker retreat center. So we have all the resources, and we've had great teachers. Rabjom Rinpoche was here recently. Chongling Rinpoche comes regularly. We could go on and on.
Are any of those programs online now with those teachers?
Good question. We're about to have a meeting after we get through the program we're doing about how we can begin to invite them online. But the other part of it, too, is we...
Then they don't even have to physically be able to get there.
Yeah, but no, that's the fun part. I mean...
I'm just saying, but I get that it's the fun part, but this part is practical now.
Because I agree.
And it has a second thing, having leapt into this myself, it opens up to a community that's worldwide.
I totally agree. And
big plus. I get what it's nice to be in the room, that's for sure.
You know, I get what you're saying, and we're going in that direction. That's why we have this 1,200-person worldwide program we're doing.
Right.
But the quality of having the teacher here in the household and doing a small retreat, Chongling Rinpoche and 30 of us having intimate conversation, we want to continue that. But the thing is growing. So now there's a lot of people affiliating, and it looks like we're going to have membership. And so it's fun. And these are good people, and we're enjoying ourselves. So
it's such a simple and elegant concept, the wisdom seed.
Yeah.
You know, and the wisdomseed.org, or is it wisdomseed.org?
Yeah, wisdomseed.org, yeah.
Just wisdomseed.org.
No, wisdomseed.org.
Okay, so everybody check that out. And then
that's very nice of you, David.
And then... I also recommend, I have a very vivid memory, Michael, of walking around my house out here in the backyard. I was over there in the backyard talking to you on a cell phone, and you were contemplating writing your first book, and which was Awake at Work, correct?
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
And you were sort of thinking, you were doing your, and I said, you have to do it.
I remember.
It was like, yeah, man, you got to do it. And you did it, and it's a unique perspective because of all friends we have, it's not that common to find somebody who's accomplished in a kind of worldly sense and is a serious hardball Dharma practitioner. That's a full house, and so I recommend, all of Michael's books to you, and we'll put a link, on the interview with your website and your books and so forth.
That's very kind of you, David. I always, when I tell a story about, say, how'd you write your first book? I always recall people that there is this friend of mine, David Nickturn, who didn't suggest I write the book, ordered me to write the book.
Yeah. Well, what a joy, and so much fun to get to chat with you and have people share your very unique view. And, just for the audience wrapping this up, Michael has a way, he's what we call a hidden yogi. It's there's no big banners. There's no signs out front of the garage. But if you get to hang with Michael, I would call him the black belt champion of adventure. And if you get to go out, we have some amazing stories. So actually, in closing, just a quick little story that Michael and myself and Robin Ford, who's a guitar player and was in our community too, we're having dinner in New York, and we went out and we listened at the dinner. They were playing Joni Mitchell music, and Robin had played with her, so there was that connection there. And Michael and Robin and I went out after that to go have a drink at a local bar, and Michael says, we should go to this place right on the corner here. It's like every time I go there I have some kind of adventure. And we walked into that bar, and Joni Mitchell was sitting at the bar. And then we had a whole nother adventure going all over the town with her that night. And that's what Michael brings to the party, ladies and gentlemen. He brings the magic.
Well, David, there's a little thing here that I should add to this.
Yes, sir.
So when I was talking to Joni that night, she starts telling me the story. She says, just last week or a couple of weeks ago, I spent the night talking to a woman by the name of Justine, who gave her child away when she was young. She had to. Her parents, she had a child and hasn't seen her. And she was married to a guy named Michael. And she went, blah, 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 blah. And I said, that's my wife. And she goes, you're kidding me.
And there was about 14 other things that night that compounded, which was Joni was saying that the guy she was with, whenever she and he went out to have a drink, they would bump into some kind of synchronous experience.
Right, right.
And then we all left that bar, and on the street, we bumped into four more of her friends and went into another joint and closed it. So listen, my friends, everybody should know that Michael does bring the magic and is a magical friend and being and, you know, beloved friend and very special and hidden, you know. So you should check it out, read the books. It's called what we call Hidden in Plain Sight. That's what Michael is. So thank you so much for joining the podcast, Mike. And of course, we'll be carrying on with our usual shenanigans, and we'll give all your contact info. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And thank you, Michael.
All right.
Okay.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.